Now, in looking at the early automation stuff in the 50s, what strikes me is we have, like you say, good ideas, but we have a bunch of folks trying to build special purpose machines that basically disappeared once the general purpose computer became in effect, and when we sort of began to get into it, would handle information. Is that your impression, or what is your impression?
Yeah, I think you're probably right. In many ways, they probably were ahead of themselves. And the best idea people sometimes aren't the best people to build equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And there has to be something more than just something in what was considered then a small field. In order to provide the fuel to essentially have big developments, I mean, you have to have, in the information field, and as we saw the information field, and the information field today now covers everything. But as we saw the information field, say in the scientific and technical information field, which is one of the segments, we weren't considered big players. I mean, we were doing some interesting things, but we weren't considered big players then. And certainly in the 50s, people weren't paying much attention to us. And within our own ranks, we were having problems. We were fighting ourselves. We weren't fighting anybody else.
Mm-hmm. Fighting over these individual little small systems.
Individual small things. And the biggest portion of our community, in terms of information community, were the librarians. And the librarians really weren't on board with us. I mean, they'd watch what was going on, but they didn't think that those guys were going to break that, so that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's fine.
They still laughed at these punch card systems and at the things like the Western Reserve Selector and Edge Notch cards.
And the McBee cards.
McBee cards.
Yeah, sure. Well, those things worked, and they made sense. And they provided a service. For certain things, they were good.
Mm-hmm.
For big databases, they were impossible. They were nice little things you could play with, but you couldn't handle anything big with it.
What about those ideas like semantic factoring, telegraphic abstracts that Perry was working on? Do you think there's much left there in terms of basic ideas, or has all that been replaced by full text searching and those kinds of things?
Well, I think with the capacity you have now, I think the new technology is just changing it.
Mm-hmm. So,
and people are looking for new things now.
Mm-hmm.
And you throw things under the rubric now of this information highway. An information highway that's 20 lanes across and there's no lines and no rules and just general chaos, that's all.
Yeah.
You can get on and get some information, there's just no question. You can go to places you've never been before, you can get all kinds of stuff. Last time on my PC, I pulled out some great pictures of Mars and what have you, and said, that's great. There are other, it's just all I'm just saying today is that there's going to have to be a lot more discipline built into the systems.
Mm-hmm. Anything left idea-wise that from the 50s that impacted the 60s or even impacted the 70s in terms of the documentation ideas?
Well, in the documentation field, I think there was. Remember, in the early years, and in the 40s, and in the 50s, the professional societies essentially were the disciplinary information systems,
mm-hmm.
and they only dealt with published materials. If it wasn't published, they weren't going to cover it. If it wasn't published and hadn't been put through peer review, they ain't going to cover it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. At the end of World War II and into the space age, we started pouring out documents at a phenomenal rate. Completely different type of law, the average document was somewhere between 50 and 100 pages, some more, some occasionally less. The average article in a journal was 7 to 10 pages. Completely different. One had been through peer review. One was primarily concerned in getting something out fast. And maybe not worried about peer review because it was competing with the guys who weren't doing peer review. See, they got to get that thing out early. Yeah. Or you want to patent it. Something.
Yeah, right.
Something. So if you publish it as a report, in those early days, that was not considered publishing. So you could still go ahead and patent it.
Right.
And so, you know, there are a lot of different things that happen. All I'm just saying is that there are a number of different factors which pushed things in the 60s. That if we had the same people in the 60s thinking the same things in the 50s, they probably, a lot of those things would have been done.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, let's move to where all this was supposed to be generating the funds to support it, and that's namely NSF. You were there from 70 to 72. You said you didn't like it. Why is that?
That's because of my peculiarities. That's because of Mel Day.
Okay. Which is?
I like doing things. Even though I ran programs, I was always actively involved in my operations.
The day-to-day?
Day-to-day operations. I did try not to micromanage, and I usually did. Except in the beginning when I micromanaged Doc Inc., but we won't go into that. But the I just liked it the same way I used to be a chemist. When I used for 10 years after I left the chemical lab, when I'd walk into a chemical lab, my hands would itch. I wanted to get in and do something.
You're back there and wash the test tubes again.
And wash it. Well, not wash it, but put something in the test tube. Get something happen. And all I'm saying is that the big excitement to me is building something and getting it to work. And building information systems and programs. And mine involved programs as well as systems. And getting them to work. And this involves government people, private sector people, Americans, people from all, to me that's exciting. I mean,
NSF was not this.
Well, NSF was different. NSF always considered itself kind of the elite as far as the government science community is concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't say they weren't. Don't misunderstand. They were a granting agency. They didn't do things. They gave money to other guys who did things. And all I'm saying is, I wanted somebody to give me money to do things. That's all I'm trying to say. My fun is helping to design and develop an approach, and then making it work.
Mm-hmm.
And making it do something to improve the quality of life for somebody, mm-hmm. or to improve the status or the prestige of America, of the U.S. government. I mean, a lot of the things I did that. I know it did that.
Mm-hmm. And a research building, a research and development system didn't have that same kind of appeal?
I wasn't building a research and development system.
No, I don't mean your own, but helping support it and build it out there in the world.
Well, because to me, aside from, somebody has to do it, and some guys like doing it, and that's mm-hmm. fine. You need those people, and they make a major contribution. I'm just saying this is because of Mel Day.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But if you ask me about my kicks, my kicks are getting people and their resources together to solve problems, the information problems, okay? And from an operational standpoint. Now, I realize this has to be based on a lot of a lot of R&D work, and this is fine. Without those people, we aren't going to have anything over here. Don't misunderstand me. But let me tell you, all the work they do, a lot of the work they do will come to naught if you don't have God to put the stuff to work. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you know, it just goes out as, well, that was interesting, but nothing ever happened. And nobody ever did anything.
Dealing with the grant application didn't, to decide what to fund, didn't have that same kind of...
Didn't have any kicks for me. Well, let me tell you why. The day that I came in to the National Science Foundation, I had a staff meeting with my people. And my deputy, oh my God, you know, but my deputy at that time asked me what I was going to do, and I told him about some of the things I would like to do at that particular point in time.
Go ahead, I'm just going to shut the door.
Came around to me about 2 weeks after I was there and says to me, "You don't know what you're doing."
Oh. Your deputy said that.
Yeah. I said, "Well, you may be right. Why don't you tell me about it?" Okay. The guy says, "You just don't know what you're doing." Well, I says, "What do you mean I don't know what I'm doing?" He says, "You don't understand that our job is to give away money." Says, "That's not my job. My job is to provide funds for people to do something, but to do something that appears to be reasonable, that appears to be in support of what this program is supposed to be doing, okay, and it appears to have some reasonable chance of success. Maybe it won't be successful, but you know, if it's completely off the wall and nobody says it's going to work, well, then maybe I don't want to support it. It won't, the peer review will kill it. Okay? But my job is not giving away money. Now, why do you raise this point?" "Well, because you asked for justification on everything." Well, I did. Now, I'll admit that my background was different than their background. My background came out of contracts, awarding contracts. I never gave anybody any grants until that particular time. But all I wanted was to make sure that the taxpayer essentially was getting his money's worth, or appeared to be, to the best of my ability, was getting his money's worth. So my big objection to the National Science Foundation, from me, doesn't mean I can't work there. I could work there. There's a lot of prestige involved. You know, I mean, I was sitting on all these committees, head of Office of Science Information Service. I had my own statutory authority, which I have to credit Bert Atkinson and Alberto Thompson for getting. I had my own science information committee that was by law. They couldn't put that out of commission. But you know, your law only lasted 20 years. That's why they set that thing up. And 2 years after I left, when I leave, I turn around and I walk away from an operation and I don't look back. Because it's his watch. And if I think he's doing something wrong, I'll keep that inside. I don't say anything. I mean, that's his business. You know, if he's going to blow the place up, that's different. But I mean, everybody has, maybe his views are right and mine are wrong. That's not up for me to interfere. I don't want to do anything. I have a certain amount of influence in the field. I know a lot of people, but I don't want to spoil it for him. So I just keep quiet.
Who followed you at NSF?
Lee Bergstrom. That was the end of the Office of Science Information Service. Lee, I called Lee 2 years afterwards. I said, "Lee, the statutory authority for the Office of Science Information Service is running out." I said, "It's very easy to get it renewed." And I said, "If I may make a suggestion, this is all that has to be done. I don't have any problem. I have all the support I need here. I don't need that kind of stuff." Well, let me tell you, when that ran out, they eliminated his office. They have headed the Office of Science Information Service. That's between us. His background was different than mine. He was a PhD. His field was education, I guess. Mm-hmm. He's very articulate. He's a very bright guy.
He came from the ERIC system, right?
He set up the ERIC system, which was at least 5 years behind NASA's system. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But he came in 5 years after the NASA system was gone.
Yeah.
And that's fine. His system was set up in a different system. He didn't want to operate anything. That's the difference. He didn't want to operate anything. And his system was set up at a number of universities around the country. Well, this gave him political support for the Office of Education at that particular point in time. So that may have been a good move. From an information organization standpoint, I feel that's a terribly inefficient way to do things. Because as many centers as he had different guys, different girls, different systems. They all, each one wanted to do his thing his way, right? And especially in an academic community. I mean, you thrive on independence, right? That's fine. I mean, that's not being critical. Don't misunderstand. But what I'm saying is that in many ways, it's just a lot more difficult to run a system like that. That's all. His system, he could get away with it in his system because it was an education. What are you going to measure? You can't measure anything. What are you going to measure? The educators say it's good. I guess it's good. What are you going to measure?
Speaking of measurement, because I'm afraid I will forget this, the Cranfield studies were done in the mid-'63, somewhere along there.
Yeah, they were good.
Did you use any of that methodology to go and evaluate?
Yeah, I knew those people over there because I was active in AGARD.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew those people. And I guess I used it, but I can't remember how I used it at this particular point. I tried to use the literature. I've always tried to keep up on the literature. I did not have as much patience with some of the far out R&D because I didn't have time, and there was no application at that time, and it wasn't going to help the program as far as I mean I just didn't have the time. If I spent it on that, I wasn't going to spend it on the bigger payoff. So I didn't, some of the work that was going on at university I know was good work. I didn't pay that much attention to some of it. I'd follow what appears in the journals and I'd read it. And I'd say, when I get a little bit further, I'll see what happens.
Does something like machine translation fall into that?
Machine translation. Machine translation, 30 years ago, they were doing machine translations. I mean, the U.S. Air Force, 30 years ago, was putting $25 million a year into machine translations. Okay? People talk about all this wonderful machine translations. If you want to put a translator, that's a good first cut. That's fine. Now you put a translator on there and he'll clean up what's missing. You probably save an awful lot of time and maybe a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
But the money that we get out of it is different because the problems inherent in machine translation, it's not all black and white. It's quantic. It's everything.
Yeah, right. Pretty complicated. You talked about cutting CAS off. Why did you decide to do this when you were at NSF? They had gotten how much money before you came, and then how much?
Pretty close to $25 million.
Now, by the time you left, or
I left, I think the last thing, maybe $100,000.
Okay. So Atkinson had given them $25 million.
Yeah, the first question I asked when I came in is, what do these people know with this money?
And
okay.
He said?
And why does it continue so long? I mean, how long? I've been developing since. I know what it takes. I didn't develop it myself, but I know you can get guys out there that can develop systems, and it doesn't take 20 years, or it doesn't take 10 years. Okay? I know that. You know that, and I know that. Because when you set up in the private sector, for profit, private sector, you set goals. You get your money, you get equipment, you get everything designed to do such and by such and such a time. Now, maybe you can get a little extra time on that. But it isn't going to be this much extra time. Because there has to be so much of it continues to be R&D. It's development. They never will have anything done because there's always ways to make it better. And all I'm saying, as of a certain date, this is Mark 1. Okay, now let's get Mark 1 going, and we'll start working on Mark 2. That's fine. I have no problem with that. Okay? But let's not wait till we get to Mark 10 before we get anything going. That's all I'm saying.
And you think Kim Abstract did that?
Well, I don't think they had the... Because they knew money was coming in. I don't think they worried so much about it.
Setting goals and
I mean, that's, they could... You know, they knew it was coming in. And as long as dirt was there, they were getting it.
Was chemistry a more difficult problem than you had in NASA?
Sure.
Intellectually, I mean, particularly with chemical notation, chemical nomenclature,
could
structure,
be.
All those
could
things.
Could be.
But still not enough to justify... 10, 12 years?
I mean, I just think that there was no... Their main emphasis had to be on putting out that abstract journal. Because there were their backlogs... You can get some of the old-timers, they'll tell you their backlogs were killing them.
Well, in 1962, they had a 22-month backlog.
Okay. So there was no way they could do... I mean, it was going to be worse by 1964. And by 1968, it would have been a disaster. So the only way they could do it, Brick did the right thing, was to provide funds. My only criticism is that you might have, because Brick was all part of this national thinking in terms of national systems. If he weren't part of it, I wouldn't probably be as critical. But he knew what everybody else was thinking. He knew the mistakes that we made in the government sector. This guy got off and started big, and now this is, now here we get a bunch of people who want to work together, but you know, what the hell can we do together? You see? And that's and but Bert didn't want to take that one on. And that's, he didn't think that way. I mean, that's not necessarily bad. He just, he was thinking about, he did a lot more in supporting some of the basic stuff. And that he was very good at. And he was a very good politician up on the hill. A very good politician on the hill.
Did you like that aspect of doing the politics?
Not particularly. But I would do it. I would do it. I do it because that's what you had to do in order to get what you want. But the... I'll tell you a funny story about Bert. Bert used to like to smoke cigars. Bert's the one who sponsored me for this group.
I think you told me that.
And Bert, we had a Casati meeting. Andy Ains set it up at where they just had this big blow up, you know, about the sergeants that took advantage of the women up the road here in Aberdeen.
Mm-hmm.
And the man who was head of Casati, the chairman of Casati, was a 3-star general from defense. He was in charge of all defense R&D at that point in time. Andy reported to him, he was a colonel. And we had this meeting, and of course, we were at a military post, and all of us were in civilian clothes. And... they got the word there that this 3-star general was coming. And Admiral Ely was his name, the nicest guy in the world. He doesn't come wearing his uniform. He comes wearing some clothes like the rest of us. So we all get out there, and we know that we're going to walk over to where this meeting. But they had already had the commanding general, I guess, to get the word that this 3-star general was coming, so... he made sure that the motor pool was going to have a driver over there to pick up General Ely. So this poor driver drives up, and he sees all these guys standing out there. And there's this one guy standing out there like this, puffing on his great big black cigar. He figures, that's General Ely. That's Bert Atkinson. And he hops out, parks up, hops out, rushes around, opens up the rear door, asked him to get in, and dries off. And really, the rest of my just standing there going into a storage. That was Burke. He didn't mean anything bad. He was just he just enjoyed it. That's all.
That's great.
Well, leaving NSF to the National Library of Medicine, I gather NLM you saw as the kind of challenge you like.
Well, NLM had an operational job. I had a call from Marty Cummins, who's director of the library. He asked me to come over on a Saturday morning. He and I have been friends for many years. And he knew that I was good. He knew my reputation. I had a very good reputation.
So this was Martin Cummins?
Martin said. Cummins. So he took me out, takes me around to the back of the building. And there's a big gully over there right beside the National Library of Medicine. Now there's a big building there. But in those days, there was a big gully. He says to me, he said, Mel, do you see it? And Marty, what am I supposed to see? What's it? He says, the Lister Hill Center. I said, what am I supposed to be looking for? I mean, all I see is this big gully. I mean, what am I supposed to be looking for? And he says, I want you to go over and help me build the Lister Hill Center. And so I didn't really. I knew a little bit about it, but the Lister Hill Center was up on the mezzanine of the lab. And it was set up for Lister Hill, Center mm-hmm. Lister Hill. But we didn't have any building. We went over there, and every time we put it in a budget, it'd get knocked out. President's budget always knocked it out. And I was over there, and I liked the National Library of Medicine as far as government information. Is the best place in government to work. No question in my mind. Has the best staff, highest paid, but the best. Works in a great environment. It's almost like an academic environment. Okay. But it's got a lot of discipline built into the system because it has a huge budget. The budget now must be $175 million. When I was here, it was $45. That was a big budget for government programs in those days, $45 million. And that didn't include rent because, you know, that comes into some other item. I don't know the old days for that. But it's a great field. You're doing something that's going to help people. And, you know, it's going to help people. There's just no question about it. It's not going to help everybody, but it's going to help somebody. You don't worry about national boundaries. We send stuff down to Cuba. We don't send them anything else. They get anything they want from National Library of Medicine. Mm-hmm. So, you know, no matter who it is, you try to help. You mm-hmm. like being part of this to be helping people. You don't know the people. You don't know the faces. You don't know the names. You don't care. You're just helping people. And it was a great place to work. Marty was a very good director. He had a heart attack shortly after I got there, and so essentially let me run the program.
Let me switch tapes here just a minute now.
And I'll tell you a funny story about Marty Cummins.